This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. hosts China for talks about several difficult bilateral issues. Social media offers comfort to Syrian refugees. California prepares for a rough wildfire season.
We're staffing up. We're going to augment staffing on high fire danger days. But really, the key is a prepared community. They are our partners.
Classical music makes some unusual friends. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. The United States and China are engaging this week in their seventh strategic and economic dialogue. The cabinet-level discussions in Washington involve hundreds of diplomats from both countries. Secretary of State John Kerry and Treasury Secretary Jack Lew are hosting the meetings. State Department spokesman John Kirby says there will be a wide range of issues addressed.
We are looking to expand our bilateral cooperation on many global challenges such as climate change, development, humanitarian assistance, pandemic response, and ocean conservation. We'll also have the chance to coordinate U.S. and Chinese policies on regional issues like Iran, Iraq, and Syria, North Korea, and Afghanistan. And we will also address areas where we have ongoing differences, such as maritime disputes, cybersecurity, and human rights. As we have said many times, the United States is firmly committed to improving its relationship with China.
Kirby says while the countries disagree on many points, including cybersecurity and maritime disputes, they recognize there are many areas for mutually beneficial cooperation. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins is following the discussions and spoke with VOA's Jim Stevenson.
The U.S. and China are addressing some of the thorny issues, and one of them, of course, is cybersecurity. In his statement, Vice President Joe Biden said there is an urgent need to agree on a rule-based system for rapidly evolving areas such as cyberspace and outer space. He didn't call China by name, but he commented on the heels of a massive U.S. government data breach that has affected millions of federal workers, and some believe China is linked to that hack. Biden said nations that use cyber technology as an economic weapon or profit from the theft of intellectual property are sacrificing tomorrow's gains for short-term gains today. Chinese State Counselor Yang Jiechi said that China believes that cybersecurity is very important. He said that China also believes that countries should work together to develop international codes of conduct for cyber information sharing.
Now, Pam, I understand there's also the need for physical security, and that stems from activities in the South China Sea.
Yes, it does. Secretary of State John Kerry said that the U.S. was going to use the dialogue in part to raise issues about regional security in the Asia-Pacific region, including the South China Sea. One of the issues that has been thorny between the two countries is that China has a land reclamation project in the South China Sea in areas that are claimed by other countries. Kerry said that he would work to address this issue with China, and he also said that he would address human rights concerns.
Cybersecurity and the South China Sea, of course, are some thorny issues between the two nations. What are some of the areas of cooperation that we're seeing?
One of the big areas of cooperation in today's talks has been climate change. China and the United States are already cooperating on a series of projects related to environmental protection, clean energy, and climate change. And today they announced six new eco-partnerships, as they call them, which are private sector projects between U.S. and Chinese companies. One of those deals with monitoring air pollution near chemical industrial parks, and another one deals with tracking sea turtle migration as part of an effort to help restore habitat.
State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins speaking with VOA's Jim Stevenson. There are a couple of ways that you can follow the U.S.-China talks here in Washington on social media. Michael Lippin is here to tell us more. Michael, where can people go online?
Hi, Ray. Well, I can tell you that the U.S. State Department is using a few Twitter accounts to provide updates on those U.S.-China talks. Its main account has the handle @StateDEPT, that's short for department. Then you have two offices within the State Department also tweeting about the dialogue. One of them is the U.S. Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs, whose handle is at U.S. Asia Pacific. The other is the State Department's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, whose account name is at ECA at State.
The State Department's a busy place, but they seem to have time to tweet about this, Michael. So what are they tweeting about?
Well, they're making the time, Ray. And I had a look at Twitter and found a couple of tweets worth mentioning, such as this one from at U.S. Asia Pacific. And that tweet said, "Cooperation on climate change is a high priority in the U.S.-China relationship. We are working together to show leadership and take concrete actions." And here's one that I saw from at ECA at State. "Communication is critical for connecting the U.S. and China. Hashtag American English can help to bring youth together." That tweet also links to a State Department Facebook page called American English at State, and that contains information about American English language and culture. And one other Twitter account that people can follow, of course, is that of U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. His account is at John Kerry, and this is what he tweeted earlier today. "Honored to take part in my third U.S.-China strategic and economic dialogue, an opportunity to discuss a broad range of important issues between our countries." And if you'd like to get the Chinese government's perspective, you can follow the China Xinhua News Agency account at XH News. That account highlighted the environmental agenda of Tuesday's talks. It posted one headline that read, "China and the U.S. agree to hold a summit on climate smart cities in Los Angeles this year, hashtag China-U.S. dialogue." Xinhua also ran a tweet quoting the Chinese climate envoy at the talks as saying, "China-U.S. cooperation on hashtag climate change is very successful." Ray?
Thank you, Michael. VOA's Michael Lippin. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. The strategic and economic dialogue, by its very definition, has much to do with the economy. New York business correspondent Alexis Christophorus talked earlier about it with VOA's Jim Stevenson.
China and the U.S. certainly have no shortage of things to talk about. Some of the hot topics expected to come up include the two nations' bilateral investment treaty that would offer equal treatment to companies in each country. Officials are also expected to discuss the Chinese yuan's possible inclusion in the International Monetary Fund's special currency benchmark. And, of course, climate control and diplomacy on North Korea are expected to be on the agenda. But actually, some fence mending may be just as much a focus. China is suspected of orchestrating a massive cyber attack on U.S. government computers, and China's building of man-made islands in the south of China Sea is also a point of contention. And both sides here really have an interest in reducing their tensions, especially ahead of the Chinese president's visit to the White House. That's going to happen in December, Jim.
Well, of course, we know about Google and its forays into China. It had a little bit of a bumpy road there. But now it looks like Google is the latest company to enter the crowded streaming music industry. What can you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, you know, Apple, Spotify, Pandora, they're all competing to become the dominant streaming music service. But Google wants to make sure you haven't forgotten about its own music app. It's called Google Play Music. And so the company has announced it will be rolling out a free version of Google Play Music. And it won't let you pick specific songs like the paid version, but it will let you choose from a variety of what it's calling human-curated and very specific playlists. So think of this more like internet radio with dozens of DJs than a music on-demand service. And these playlists are created and curated by Google's team of music experts. But this is not a new concept. Apple's new streaming service also has a radio station called Beats One, and that features live DJs that broadcast music around the clock. But I guess in the end, we'll have to see if Google Play Music strikes the right chord with listeners.
International Edition's Alexis Christophorus in New York.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz! Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
The United States will pre-position about 250 tanks, along with other heavy weapons and military equipment, in six European countries, including the Baltic states. It's all being done to reassure NATO allies against threats from Russia and terrorist groups. Speaking in Estonia's capital, Tallinn, on Tuesday, Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter said Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, along with Bulgaria, Romania, and Poland, could move the equipment around the region for training and military exercises. After Russia annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula last year, NATO leaders agreed to increase military exercises and rotations of forces through NATO allies in Eastern Europe and to store military equipment there for use in case of an emergency. The Russia-backed rebels in Ukraine's southeast say they are fighting for autonomy from authorities in Kiev, who leaned to Europe and the West. But as the rebels struggle to define that autonomy, the region is increasingly dependent on Russia. Meanwhile, growing numbers of war-weary people in Donetsk are becoming indifferent to their political future. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports.
Donetsk coffee shop owner Yelena says they used to get numerous kinds of beans from western Ukraine, but now only get two. Russian suppliers are quickly taking over at grocery stores seized by the rebels, while shipment delays at checkpoints to the west can take 10 hours.
We were directly touched by the situation because most of the products are simply absent.
Supermarkets carry less variety, and prices for the few goods on the shelves are high. For some people, it's too expensive to buy at supermarkets, not to mention going to a cafe. Yelena voices an increasingly common view here. She does not care who controls the region.
The main issue is not having any war, and for me to be able to work calmly and walk on the street without fear, and for people to be healthy and there to be no gore. This is the main thing, and I don't care who we belong to.
Despite a February deal for wider autonomy, the Russia-backed rebels say too much blood has been spilled for the region to remain part of Ukraine. Rebel Colonel Alexander Kurenkov feels this personally.
My son was killed in this war, Private Ivan, in Elenovka. And do you think my wife can forgive it? I don't have any brothers on that side. I hate it when they say this is a war of brother nations.
The rebel leaders only represent themselves and Moscow, responds Ukrainian presidential spokesman Rostislav Pavlenko. He adds authorities in Kiev will negotiate autonomy and restore financial ties only after fighting stops and elections are held under Ukrainian law.
This will allow the state to be sure that those social commitments could be done in full and that payments will go to the people who should get them and not the people with guns.
With Russia's backing evident and the rebels still looking to Moscow for guidance, ordinary people here simply yearn for peace and seem to care little about any particular political future. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Donetsk.
Zaatari is a sprawling makeshift city in Jordan. It may be the only refugee camp to tweet its activities, hoping to keep donors motivated as the war in Syria intensifies and the humanitarian crisis deepens. Inside the camp, families say mobile phone applications are emotionally holding together families that are physically torn apart. VOA's Heather Murdoch has details.
Mohammed El Rafai sells mobile phones at a shop in the market in Zaatari, a refugee camp near Jordan's border with Syria that houses more than 80,000 people. Over the roar of one of the generators that are the camp's main source of electricity, El Rafai describes the phones in his shop. Many people here say for families separated by war, information and communication are almost as important as food and shelter.
Hey.
As he flips through his mobile phone, El-Rafai's friend shows us the news from Syria.
The suffering in Syria and the killing.
El-Rafai says he uses Facebook to keep track of the news and WhatsApp to keep track of his family. He says his family in Syria moves from place to place, fleeing the violence. Not many people have laptops at the camp, he says, but everyone who can afford it has a smartphone. And the news source of choice for many residents is a Zaatari Facebook page run by refugees that reports what's going on inside the camp and in their neighborhoods at home. On a dusty street lined with tents and trailers, Mohammed Hamza Rafai says half the people in the camp follow this page. Aid workers say they also use social media to raise funds, which is increasingly difficult after more than 4 years of war. Zaatari is the first refugee camp to have a Twitter account, reporting news from inside, says the camp's UN Refugee Agency spokesman, Nasreddin Toibia.
In terms of raising awareness, it's very efficient. We are reaching out to a larger audience, and we are targeting all people from all walks of life. And we see them interacting with us, asking questions, wanting to find out how is the situation in Zaatari, how are refugees coping with Zaatari.
Since the war began, about half the population of Syria has been displaced and hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. Young people here say they are constantly looking for new apps for their phones to keep track of their families cheaper and more often. Some doubt a Twitter feed will offer much direct relief, but when there is enough electricity to operate mobile phones, social media offers at least a little comfort. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Zaatari Camp, Jordan.
Still to come, the fire season gets ready to roar in California.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
Human Rights Watch is calling on European Union nations to better provide for children from Afghanistan, Syria, and other nations seeking asylum in Europe. VOA Susan Yaki spoke about the appeal with HRW Advocacy Director for Children, Joe Becker.
We interviewed dozens of children last month in Greece who had recently arrived from war-torn countries, especially from Syria and Afghanistan. And what we found is that many of these children are traveling thousands of miles on their own, not because they just want a better life, but because they feel that they have no choice, that they can't stay in their home countries because of abuses, including child recruitment, child marriage, attacks on their schools, and other violations. These children really need protection, and instead, many of them are being detained for long periods of time and getting very little assistance.
What particular countries are they coming from and going to?
Over 60% of the refugees, asylum seekers, and migrants entering Greece right now are coming from Syria and Afghanistan. And these are countries where children face particular abuses. In Syria, over 3,500 schools have been destroyed. Most children have very little chance of an education any longer. There's recruitment going on by armed groups and, you know, just very severe insecurity. In Afghanistan, there's also, you know, recruitment by the Taliban, by other groups. One family told us of a Taliban leader who insisted on marrying their 10-year-old daughter, and they believed that if they refused, they would be killed. So instead, they chose to take their children and escape and try and reach Europe for safety. These are some of the stories from these children and their families. They are traveling not because they want to, but because they feel they have no choice.
What would you like the European Union to do about this?
Well, for one thing, they need expedited processing. Some of the children who travel alone are experiencing a perverse punishment. They're taking all these risks to reach Europe, and then because they're children, they're being detained longer than adults because there aren't adequate shelter places available for them. So Greece needs greater resources to deal with children who are traveling alone. And Europe needs to place particular priority on children, their vulnerabilities, and the fact that they're often experiencing unique abuses in their home countries because they're children.
Joe Becker, Human Rights Watch Advocacy Director, talking with VOA's Susan Yockey. The western U.S. state of California is bracing for a serious wildfire season. California is in its fourth year of severe drought. Firefighters are getting ready, and local officials are urging the public to help. Here's VOA's Michael Sullivan.
There have already been major wildfires, like the so-called Lake Fire, now burning in the mountains east of Los Angeles, and the Saddle Fire in Northern California, which burned more than 600 hectares before it was contained. Regional fire officials in Southern California say this fire season, which usually starts in June, got started early and is going to be harsh. Darrell Osby is chief of the Los Angeles County Fire Department, and he joined regional fire officials at a news briefing.
This is the fourth year of an ongoing drought, so we're really concerned about the amount of dead vegetation in our area.
The area has received just enough light rain recently to encourage the growth of small brush and grass, which has dried to create potential fuel for fires, says Robert Garcia of the U.S. Forest Service.
The grasses, the pine needles, a really light, fine vegetation.
California Office of Emergency Services Director Mark Ghilarducci says the dry conditions make fire volatile.
And so fires have the ability to start very fast and spread very rapidly and get out of control very fast.
Firefighters train continuously and say they respond to fire outbreaks in a matter of minutes. But much of the region has homes close to wilderness areas, and homeowners need to stay alert and keep brush cleared from their property, says Ventura County Fire Chief Mark Lorenzen.
We're well trained, we're prepared, we're staffing up. We're going to augment staffing on high fire danger days. But really the key is a prepared community. They are our partners.
He says that most importantly, residents must follow evacuation orders, which not all of them do. These officials say the fires will come, but that through working together, firefighters and the community can minimize the damage. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Celebrity news and facts with Action Reaction.
The Jackson family produced a pool of talent, as in Michael Jackson, Janet Jackson, Jermaine Jackson, and so on. But the Jacksons aren't the only family with more than one star hanging from their tree.
Hey, how'd you get that picture of me? I look amazing.
Comedy actress Melissa McCarthy, currently starring in the movie Spy.
Hello, doppelganger.
Happens to be related to TV host and former Playboy playmate Jenny McCarthy. They're first cousins. NBC's Al Roker is America's best known weatherman. So what's the forecast for his surprise relation? Very cool. It's musician and Hunger Games star Lenny Kravitz. Roker confirms their grandfathers were cousins. Legendary producer Quincy Jones has worked with some of pop music's best-known stars. Daughter Rashida Jones has also made quite the name for herself in hit TV shows like The Office and Parks and Recreation. For VOA's Action Reaction, I'm Lisa Vora.
Classical music is showing the way for Jews and Arabs to become friends. A project based in the Israeli cities of Nazareth and Jaffa is helping to bring them together. Some of the project's musicians came to New York recently to perform, as we hear from VOA's Carolyn Weaver.
These young musicians, two Israeli Jews, two Israeli Arabs, are in New York to perform as the Polyphony Quartet, an ensemble created by the Israel-based Polyphony Foundation. Revital Bandersky and Shar Hayat are violinists and Jewish. Faris Mashour, a violinist and violist, is a Palestinian Christian, and Mahdi Saadi, a cellist, is Muslim. Polyphony began in 2006 as a small school in Nazareth to bring classical music to Arab children, says founder and music director Nabil Aboud Ashkar.
There was never a real proper opportunities for young Arab children to learn classical music, and this is what we were able to change. We showed everyone that there's no reason why an Arab kid shouldn't be able to play classical music on a high standard.
The school flourished as teachers, most of them Israeli Jews, drove 2 hours from Tel Aviv to teach the children. Out of that, Polyphony was formed to further music education and to bring together young Palestinian classical music students to perform with their Jewish peers. Friendships developed among people who would otherwise have no reason to meet.
Polyphony changed all my thinking and how I see people, how to accept them, and how to be accepted also. Yeah, I never had a Jewish friend before, and I never thought that I will have.
I started looking at things a bit differently, and like Madi said, I never had Arab friends before, and it started all in Polyphony.
For example, rehearsals, we do rehearsals, we start to know each other more, and we start to trust each other in the concerts. In case of somebody do a mistake, we always need somebody to help us, to support. Yeah, so we're more as a family team, family music team.
At one of their New York performances at the Unitarian Church of All Souls, a piece by Mozart was on the program. Among those listening were Polyphony co-founders Craig and Deborah Kogut, whose financial support has expanded the program to train 130 teachers. And this year, Polyphony's music education programs in elementary schools and kindergartens are projected to reach 10,000 other young Israeli Arabs. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Sexual violence in conflict is an atrocity that stands in the way of peace, prosperity, and gender equality. In Iraq and Syria, ISIL is making life hell for women and girls. The situation is especially grim for members of minority populations. Thousands of girls and women were abducted by ISIL last summer. Many, including girls as young as 7 or 8, were repeatedly raped and forced to marry ISIL fighters. Others have been sold as slaves. The United States is providing both humanitarian aid and other kinds of assistance. But the international community needs to do more to protect and better serve women and girls affected by the conflict. For example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, sexual violence has become a weapon that destroys lives, fuels conflict, and stands in the way of lasting peace. The U.S. is working to build a coherent approach to justice. Judges are holding open trials in local areas so witnesses can testify in their own communities. In turn, those communities can see firsthand that sexual violence will not go unpunished and that impunity will not be tolerated. Sexual violence in conflict continues to be a global problem that we need to address. In many headlines, women are portrayed as victims. And while there's no doubt that far too many women and girls are survivors of gender-based violence, it's not the whole story. Women are also incredible agents of change. They wield influence in their communities. They bring unique insights to decision-making tables. They increase the effectiveness of government. Gender-based violence, including sexual violence and conflict, holds women and girls back from participating fully in society. The repercussions negatively impact whole communities, halting development and leading to poorer educational, health, and economic outcomes. Tackling gender-based violence is crucial if we hope to unleash women's and girls' full potential and promote stability and economic growth.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.